Welcome back, pod people, to another episode of Cinema d'Amore. I'm James Reinhardt.
I'm Justin Morgan.
Chris Kevall.
Chuck Phillips.
And we are Cinema d'Amore!
Yeah!
America.
We're bros.
Bros talking movies. This month we're starting off a new theme or streak, as it were, as we call it. Chris, you picked this one.
Yeah, it's definitely fantastic.
You don't have to tease it anymore.
Oh, okay.
We're in it.
We're in the street.
It's my fantasy to tease it more.
It's fantasy.
Fantasy, yeah.
It's fantasy February month. Fantasy month. Sounds nerdy. It's February fantasy month. All February long.
February fantasy, I like it.
We're sorry today's episode's not Groundhog Day.
Yeah, we just kind of missed a boat. But yeah.
It would have kind of been a fantasy.
I think it would, if you picked... Chris picked fantasy theme in the order that we run. James is first. James is what I ran on today, no matter what. If he said Groundhog Day, I'd be like, that's a fantasy. I'll stretch it. I'll let it fit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I would do. But yeah, we're doing fantasy, and I want to preface this by saying I love every movie that we've picked this for this theme for various reasons. But today was my pick, and I picked Ridley Scott's 1985 movie Legend, starring Tom Cruise, Tim Curry, and Maya Sara, and a bunch of other people with character names that we can't remember, so we all have IMDb up.
A bunch of other little people.
Yeah.
I have it more up for the character, like, not the actors, just the characters.
Yeah.
There's one that I would never forget.
Which one is that?
If you want me to jump straight into it, it's everyone has these great names. Well, maybe besides the main characters, because Tom Cruise, who's the lead, is Jack, and Mia Sara is Lily, and then they just start kind of going crazy from there. We have Darkness, Gump, Blix, Screwball, but my favorite character name out of all of them...
Brown Tom?
No, Meg.
Oh, yeah.
Just Meg.
Meg Mucklebones.
It is Meg Mucklebones,
yeah.
And she makes a point to say her last name, too, but...
Yeah.
Meg. I was like, Meg? It reminded me of a Family Guy skit. I'm just like, that's Meg.
Well, I was telling this before we were recording, but in the movie, just jumping ahead, but there is like a swamp witch looking character named Meg Mucklebones. And like, the character design, I think, is kind of terrifying. And I saw this movie when I was a kid, and that character always like freaked me out. Then I remember, also grew up a big Star Trek fan, so I'd watch Star Trek Voyager, and I saw like a sign for a Comic-Con or something that's coming, and Robert Picardo was there, who played the Doctor. That was his name, the Doctor. The Doctor. And it's like, Robert Picardo, best known for Legend and Star Trek Voyager, and they show a picture of him as a doctor and a picture of him as Meg Mucklebones. As a kid, that blew my mind. I'm like, that troll woman is the Doctor?
That's crazy.
For you geeks out there.
The character design's really good. Maybe it pulls from other things, but a recent memory where I've played things such as Skyrim, because, yes, I'm sorry, I'm the type of person that's played... many, many hours of Skyrim. There's witches that look just like Meg Mucklebones.
Oh, yeah.
So when Meg Mucklebones pops out of the swamp, I'm like, looks just like the witches from Skyrim.
Yeah, she looks like, and I think it's the thing, she's supposed to be like what you always imagine a traditional witch to look like, which is part of the reason, it's part of the reason why I like really like this movie, is really drawn to this movie, is... it really looks like what you imagine a fantasy or a fairy tale to look, come to life. And I don't think any film made today looks like the way this film looks.
Like it's too CG heavy and just not enough actual elements there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And like with this film, I'm sure there's some blue screen and there are definitely matte paintings. For the most part, it's all, looks like it's all practical sets. It's all makeup effects, it's all practical effects.
The world building is really nice.
Yeah, I would say so. And like, there's a story issue.
The effects are done by Rob Bottin, who did The Thing and Total Recall.
Oh shit!
Those
Wow.
are this is what he did right after The Thing.
That's awesome.
So that's where his things are always generally terrifying and very disgusting just to look at.
His things, particularly in The Thing,
yeah,
terrifying and disgusting.
Well, what would you say is the plot of Legend?
The plot is where everything kind of starts to fall apart for me.
It's like right off the bat.
Yeah. I have a love-hate relationship with this movie, because when I was a kid, I grew up watching this movie. I had this and Clash of Titans on the same VHS tape, so I'd always watch them back to back.
Nice.
But I loved this movie, and then I remember as an adult, I got it from Netflix, and it was a director's cut. And I watched it, I'm like, well, this is kind of terrible. But then, I kept going back and rewatching it. The director's cut and the theatrical cut. And I think it's an absolutely beautiful movie, but story-wise and character-wise, I think that's where it really falls apart for me. But I guess the basic story is Tom Cruise plays a character named Jack, who's like a forest child. I think that's what they referred to him as at one point.
He's like a hermit in the forest, I guess.
He can talk to animals. If you watch a director's cut, they mention that he knows how he can speak to animals and stuff. And
he speaks goblin, troll, princess.
Further on it. Yeah.
But yeah, and he hangs out with Princess Lily, played by Maya Sarah, best known for Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And he takes her to see there are two unicorns, which are like the rarest beasts in this fantasy world, and he takes her to see them. And at the same time, Tim Curry's character, who I really want to get into.
Best in the character name for sure.
Yeah, Darkness. which, yeah, I feel like they really got lazy of that. They're like, I'll just call this guy Darkness. But
guess what his weakness is?
Light.
I think part of the reason why they called him Darkness is because they didn't want to just come out and say he was the devil, he was Diablo, he was Satan, because in the 80s it was too close to that era where parents would probably be like, oh no, you're not seeing that.
He refers to himself as Lord of Darkness.
Yeah.
So I guess he could be Lord Darkness, Lord of Darkness, the Darkness.
Yeah, because I've seen him referred to as Darkness and the Lord of Darkness in this movie.
I mean, there's definitely gotta be some correlations made that between his lair and hell.
Yeah.
You know, in the movie.
They mention heaven.
Yeah.
So they're definitely, that kind of throws whatever this fantasy world is for the religion. Christianity is apparently a part of this fantasy world.
I think that's why I was drawn to this movie too as a kid, because I grew up Catholic, and when I heard the story of Satan, the devil, and I really kind of was fascinated. Like, I was terrified.
Intrigued, yeah.
But I was really intrigued too, and I remember asking my parents, I'm like, is there a movie about the devil that I can watch? And I feel like most parents would have been like, what the fuck's wrong with you?
You can go to Sunday school more often,
yeah.
James.
So my parents put on Legend, and at the time I loved movies about knights, so this had knights fighting the devil. And to me, his lair, what do they call it? The Great Tree or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, his lair, is what I always imagined hell to look like. And Tim Curry's character is what I imagined Satan to look like, because he looks like what you imagine the devil.
He's even got the cloven hoofs.
Yeah, got cloven hooves, claws, these massive horns. Fangs, he looks like what you imagine the devil to look like. And that's who I always thought this character was. He was the devil when he was trying to kill unicorns. And as a kid, it made perfect sense to me. As an adult, I have a lot of questions.
I mean, and we were talking about how the effects look. One of the ones that is funny to me nowadays is that it's just not perfect, and it just shows a little bit more now with age, is unicorns themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They have all these shots of them frolicking and fighting with each other. And the horns are wobbling on their heads.
but yeah, so that's the plot. Is the Lord of Darkness, his minions cut the horn off of one unicorn, which seems to kill it, and they kidnap the other one, and Princess Lily gets captured with it. And Tom Cruise teams up with an elf and a fairy and a couple of dwarves.
The story is a little convoluted because it opens. We'll have to talk about director cut versus theatrical, because I have not watched it in a long time, and now I watch the director's cut, so I can't really tell the difference between them.
Mm.
But the opening of the version I saw starts with Darkness basically laying out his plan for this goblin, which I'm not really sure which goblin.
That's Blix.
Oh, that is Blix.
Mm-hmm.
Laying out all this plan for Blix, and Blix has to kill a unicorn or get the horn of a unicorn. And we find out later, after it cuts to Mia Sara's Lily, she's a princess that lives in a village. I mean, maybe I shouldn't pick apart that too much. She lives in a normal cottage, a house in the middle of the woods for being.
No, that's not her house.
No, she just
visits that house.
Oh,
yeah, they never.
That's just a weird. That's just a weird. Another weird thing where they never show where she comes from.
Yeah.
She just shows up and she's like, That woman's like...
So she does come from a castle or something. We just don't see it.
You don't see it.
She hangs out with this woman who lives in this cottage.
Yeah.
I'd imagine she would have to sneak out with no bodyguards whatsoever.
That's what I always thought the implication was, that she was sneaking out to do this, but they never say anything about that.
Meeting up with Jack, who seems kind of like her lover. But anyways, she meets up with Jack, and he shows her unicorns, and she touches a unicorn. And it seems like only after she touches a unicorn, which Jack's like, bitch, that's the rules. You don't touch magical creatures like unicorns.
She says, screw the rules. Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be what lets the goblins have the ability to kill and take its horn.
I think it's more like she's the bait. Like, I don't know how or if she's being influenced, but when Jack takes her to see the unicorns, it's like, literally, she lures the unicorn out more, and it's less guarded because it's distracted by her, which gives the goblins the chance to shoot the dart.
But did the goblins know? Did they know that a princess was going to be there, or somebody was going to be to break these rules?
Because darkness tells them to look for innocence, because that's where the that's where the unicorns are drawn to.
Mm. Okay.
But it's very much, that's another...
I'll accept that.
That's another, I think, very...
But you can tell before Miyacera starts distracting unicorns, unicorns are definitely very shook by something. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, there's some danger somewhere, and then they start stomping around, and then she starts singing, and that soothes the unicorn. And once that happens, then the goblins strike.
My interpretation was just that unicorns were, like, fucking awesome and always, like, frolicking and playing with each other, because that's what unicorns do.
They played that as another very... It felt like a very Catholic thing, kind of like how you brought up that he basically... You know, it's like the forbidden fruit. Like, he keeps telling her, no, you're not allowed to touch it. And she's like, why? And he's like, that's just the rules. Yeah. You don't touch it. And she's like, I'm going to go touch it. And then she does, and then even later, darkness tells her, he's like, isn't it your sin that cast us into darkness? Like, very much that's another weird thing, is like, oh, it's all fairy tales except this one part that's very, very Christianity.
Yeah, and a lot of darkness's play with Lily is very like, very like Catholic, like,
yeah, religious. Very, very, very religious overtones.
Yeah, where he's like trying to tempt her and like seduce her and bring her to his side,
but then also plays like 100% Beauty and the Beast. Like, he's talking to just his room that's like telling him things. They're like, he's like, I must take her, and they're like, no, you need to woo her, make her love you. And I'm like, 100% Beauty and the Beast.
That is one of my biggest questions in this movie. I guess we can get to that later, but that scene where he's just talking to like a disembodied voice that he's referring to father.
Yeah,
there is a thing like in a statue or
there's
a wall.
Like a statue that has eyes or something.
It's blinking.
Like, yeah, it has like green eyes that like, it doesn't show what it is or where it's even at in the room, but he's just like looking around, and he just talks to it, and the thing's like, yeah, woo her, make her love you. And I'm like, what is he talking to?
Yeah.
And darkness cracks his fingers, and I got this.
Yeah, because he's basically asking, he refers to this entity as father, so he's, you know, the son of something, but he's asking it for, like, dating advice, and this disembodied voice is like...
So at the beginning of this movie, Princess Lily is talking to this house in the middle of this fantastical woods. She says her piece with them and they seem to get along. Goes out into the woods to meet Jack, who does like quadruple flips. He's a suave guy. He's a suave forest man that she likes, and you know, they end up touching she ends up touching the unicorn, and immediately this beautiful place is just cast in snow, which she had a premonition, at least in the director's cut.
Yeah,
she was like concentrating on a clock, and she was seeing snow.
Yeah,
and like,
foreshadowing. Yeah,
yeah. That's only in a director's cut, which she seems to have a premonition of this deadly winter coming. But yeah, so yeah, she touches the unicorn. The goblins take the horn, and like everything's plunged into winter and darkness. Over almost like immediately, everything freezes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when he jumps in, you forgot the plot of, you know, whoever gets this ring will get to marry me. You know, she throws the ring in, and then he dives in after it, and then all of a sudden...
That's a great transition, because he comes back up, and
it's like bursts into ice and stuff.
And she's just... She's screaming, and there's thunder going on, and there's thunder snow, and just... Ugh, just everything's falling apart.
Yeah, and he doesn't even know. She heads back to that cottage, and the people living in that cottage are, like, frozen.
Yeah.
Which also is... It goes from, like, being creepy to hilarious, because, like, you know, this man and woman are frozen, then Lily hides because the goblins stop into the cottage. And I think this shot is only in a director's cut, where they go over to a crib, and they're like, oh, look, a baby, and they're rocking the crib, and it is clearly, like, a fake
baby. It's just a baby doll.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm
like, good, looks perfect. It's frozen. It can't move.
I really enjoyed early off the bat Blix and all the goblins and trolls or whatever. They automatically rhyme everything. Yeah. I like the black as midnight, black as pitch, blacker than the foulest witch. And I was like, they didn't have to do that, but apparently that's what they do.
Yeah, they speak in rhyme, which in this universe, I don't even question it, that goblins speak in rhyme. But
right.
I like that the goblins kind of have their own ulterior motives for everything early on. Like, that guy is not even... Blix is not very trustworthy when Darkness is talking to him. He seems like he's up to his own plan. Whatever that plan is, you don't know at that moment. But he's just sort of like, sure, Darkness, whatever. I'll get this unicorn horn for you.
Yeah,
because the unicorn horn is basically just a magic wand that... Does whatever you want.
I looked at it more as the other guy, the metalhead guy. What was his name?
Screwball?
Something else.
The one with the helmet.
Anyhow, he's the one that, like, wants to stand up to Darkness.
Blunder, you know. That's his name.
What's his name?
Blunder.
Blunder. Well, his name suffices. It says it all. And Darkness is like, snatches the unicorn... horn, and then just grabs him and throws him into the thing, and just that's the end of Blunder.
Whoever that bodyguard was that was like 15 feet tall, Blunder like says something about basically betraying Darkness, and this thing like goes to throw him down a pit, and he's like, I was just messing around, I was just kidding. So, you know, so he's changes teams essentially over the course of the movie. I apologize about some of the names because I'm looking at these names like
there's a lot of names.
There's a lot of names. There's lots of characters that don't really get the development. Because Blunder, you know, he tries to turn on Darkness with the unicorn horn, and he's taken to this dungeon, and later on you find out that he knows like the dwarves and the elves, and that they're buddies,
which I was totally confused about. Yeah. I had to go back and rewatch that part, and I'm like, oh yeah, it is the same dude.
Yeah, and he's just like, oh yeah, you know, I just saw a life of adventure, and this is where it brought me. And I'm like, in service of like the ultimate evil that your friends seem to hate, like what? But then, of course, you know, he ends up working with them later on.
Yeah, the world building that I really like in this movie. You know, you start with this little village in like a place that has so much wildlife, butterflies, birds, all kind of animals. And when they go off and when they first basically fuck up and have to go in search of Lily and to stop this darkness, the metaphorical darkness, I guess, and the literal darkness. I love the fact where they find a cave and they go down in this cave that's to find like the armor and the sword
for Jack to
fight Darkness, and then the there's not much going on in the world besides like they have to cross a swamp, and they have to go into his domain, which one of the trolls or goblins says something along the lines of, "This gets vacated by evil like every so often or something like." It's been a while, but since evil seems to be back, that's the place that you want to head to.
Yeah, that's where they're drawn to. But yeah, Jack, after Goes in Darkness, after Lily and the other unicorn are taken, Jack falls in with, like, a couple of dwarves and Gump, an elf, and their fairy Una, and he gets sword and armor, and they go off to, you know, save the world.
Now, Gump's character, played by David Bennett, you recognize them when you see this movie if you know the movie Tin Drum, because they filmed them within like a couple years or very so close together that he's practically just a year or two older in this. But he gives he only helps Tom Cruise's Jack character after he solves a riddle, which
yeah,
I mean, more power to Jack. I would never have solved that riddle. I'd have been like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, Gump's a pretty, like, cold-blooded character. Because, like, yeah, he's like, if you fail to solve this riddle, I'm killing you. And then there's a bunch of other times in the movie where he's just, like, he's ready to, like, fucking murder people on a... Like, at the end, where they think Lily's gonna turn, he's like, I'm just gonna kill her. Yeah.
Kill her! Kill her, Jack!
There's a couple other times where Gump's like, I'm just gonna, like... Oh, yeah, at the end, too, when they're fighting Darkness, Gump's, like, screaming, like, kill him! Kill him!
Yeah.
I'm like, this man, like, you think elves are these, like, graceful, gentle creatures, and this guy just fucking wants to kill people.
So, yeah, after winter happens, we meet a character that's Brown Tom. He's the dwarf with a frying pan that he tries to fend off the goblins to save Lily, which doesn't work out so well. And it's him and Pox that are like the two, I will say, hobbit-esque characters in this story.
Talk about him and Screwball?
But who the hell's Pox?
There is like...
Pox is... I think Pox is the pig-looking thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Let me look it up.
I'm going to stop using names. Brown Tom for sure is the...
Screwball and Brown Tom are the two...
Yeah, Pox is the pig-looking...
Two friends.
...goblin thing.
We understand the movie. It's just these names. I'm sorry.
Yeah, even then, there's still some stuff I don't understand about the movie.
But anyways, and the other character that kind of pops up or comes along into play with Gump's character, the elf, is... Una, the fairy, which I love, is like a light that they cast onto the film or something. It almost just looks like Tom Cruise is following a laser pointer around.
It reminds me of like when you see like the Peter Pan plays where like Tinkerbell is just like a little light that actors would react to. Like that's what Una is. But then Una reveals herself to Tom Cruise that she can like take form, look like a traditional fairy.
When you talk about Peter Pan, this film actually kind of translates into Steven Spielberg's Hook, almost identical, where the character Julia Roberts plays Tinkerbell, and she's kind of in love with Peter Pan character, and Una does the same thing.
He freaks out when he's not in love with her back.
Yeah, even when she glamours herself into Lily.
Yeah, well, she asks for a kiss from Jack to help them out of this jail cell that they are in.
To go get the key.
Which he does, but she doesn't like it because it wasn't a romantic kiss. Mm-hmm. And then she kind of does a thing that I didn't think about it until now, but we talked about it a couple months ago, the new Blade Runner movie.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like two people inhabiting, although like Chris said, this is glamour. This is magic to look like Lily in a real kind of creepy way for a moment.
Yeah, this movie borrows from, I feel like, almost every single Disney version of fairy tales. Like it's
a lot of
definitely
them, yeah.
You can pick up like almost every major fairy tale, like from Snow White, Sleeping Beauty. Like, is it Beauty? The whole like part where she's in the castles, Beauty and the Beast. Very specifically, I feel like. Because Justin's seen this one, the French version of the 40s.
Ridley Scott said he definitely was influenced by that.
Very much looks very similar to that. This bar is from, like, almost all those. I think that's part of why the story's so hard to make sense of, because it just feels like...
It's just a bunch of things.
The guy that was writing it's like, this is a really good part from this fairy tale. Well, this is a really good part from this fairy tale. We'll just put them together. They'll go.
Keeping the plot a little bit light and moving lightly from place to place really helps keep that dreamlike.
Yeah.
It feels like a dream.
Yeah.
If you woke up from a dream, you'd be like, this happened and this happened, and it doesn't exactly connect together, but it does kind of like flow in a certain way.
Yeah. Yeah, it has a very dreamlike quality, and it definitely like feels like a fairy tale sense is very much a morality play where it's good against evil and like love conquers all kind of thing. And you know, that those stories like are universal. They appeal to everyone for a reason. But I think like, even if they're going to keep the plot simple, just simple, like save the unicorn plot, I think the characters could have used fleshed out more.
We have a really intimidating, tough character in Darkness who very early on in the plot reveals his one weakness, which is light.
Yeah.
He's a destroyer. But light kills him. But we're going to get rid of that light by taking these unicorn horns. And once light's gone, there's nothing they can do about me anymore. Every time that I've seen a photo of Legend, it's always Tim Curry in this heavy, heavy makeup with huge horns. And I don't know why, but I was watching Family Guy the other night, and they did a legend skit where they're like, it's the big horn guy, and he kept turning around, like, stabbing people with his horns in their eyes.
Yeah, that's one of my, it's probably one of my favorite makeups in any movie is Tim Curry's makeup, because it is, it's just impressive, and it looks great, and apparently it was also incredibly uncomfortable, and Tim Curry hated every minute of it, but, you know, on screen, like, it plays well. And
he pulls it off well.
Yeah, oh yeah, he's great in this. He's, I think he only really has a few scenes when you see him full on, the rest of it is like voiceover or he's in the shadows or something.
Well, he obviously can't walk with hooves, and you never see him in the same shot where he really has the hooves.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see, he's a voice for most of the movie. Yeah, you're right. But when we were talking about Stephen King's It, the miniseries, when he went on to play Pennywise, he didn't want to do heavy makeup like he did in Legend. He said it was too much. That's why Pennywise, that was originally going to be like heavy, heavy makeup in that, ended up just being like basic clown makeup.
So, yeah, it looks like Bozo.
Yeah, apparently part of the reason why you see so little of him is like he hated the makeup and it was killing his neck at one point when they like.
The horns are heavy.
They're massive, like fiberglass horns, but apparently at one point when they told him he was wrapped, like he just tried to pull his makeup off and tried, ended up pulling up part of his skin on his neck.
Ooh.
So they had to shoot around him, which is why there's lots of scenes where, you know, you don't, you'll see like his hand, you'll hear him talking, but I think that adds to the mystique of the character, where he is in the shadows for most of the movie, and the only time you really see him is when he makes this grand entrance stepping out of a mirror to seduce Lily.
Well, my favorite part of the entire movie is the seduction of Lily.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I really like the way that it plays out like a ballet where this figure comes out of, you almost think maybe it's darkness at first because you haven't met him at this point,
mm-hmm.
and it starts dancing with Lily, and it has, it feels like the Nutcracker where they're like playing against each other but then kind of dancing in unison.
Yeah, the dance, yeah.
And I like how eventually she becomes that character. Yeah. And
it's,
I
like
really,
she's dancing with herself, basically.
Yeah.
I really love the contrast of it, too, because when she's the princess, she's all done up in white and a stereotypical princess. I don't know. I liked Dark Lily a lot more. I was like, I'm into Dark Lily. I don't know if it was by choice. It felt like whatever this dancing thing was mirrored her emotions a little bit and kind of pulled the darkness out of her. And I think when I watched this as a kid,
mm-hmm.
when I'm stupid and you're taking everything for what people are saying.
Literal, yeah.
When I took it literal as a child, I felt that he manipulated her. And rewatching it now, it's clear as day that she never was 100. She kind of played around with him, but
yeah,
not one moment did she kind of maybe, like, Stockholm Syndrome, like, fall for him. It's like she was like, nah, she had her shit together the whole time. Unless, I don't, when I watched it as a kid, I watched it on television. It was like one of the things that were on repeat. Must be 80s movies, because like Breakfast Club was like heavily in the mix with Legend for some reason. I saw the director's cut now, maybe the first time. I bought a DVD a long time ago, but to the point that I don't know really what's different. I know there's 20 minutes added to it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's like, am I thinking differently? Because obviously my memory is not good 30 years ago.
I know that there's definitely different scenes, and it's been quite a while since I've seen the theatrical cut. The last time I seen it was like, I want to say like 2004 on Cinemax. That was the very last time that I seen it.
I have a DVD that has both, and I, like I said, I always would watch, this is the first time I've watched the director's cut in a long time, and it actually really changed my opinion of the movie, because I would watch a theatrical cut a lot because I really liked the score by Tangerine Dream. Like, it's kind of over the top and it's kind of dated, but I really like it.
Is that the one at the very end?
There's a song at the very end, but there's like a very 80s synthy score.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But the Tangerine Dream, they're popular. They did a lot of scores in the 80s. But I liked it a lot, so I'd always watch the theatrical cut, but I always thought the theatrical cut was a pretty terrible movie. But this is the first time in a long time I watched the director's cut, which has a score by Jerry Goldsmith, the more traditional score. And I changed my opinion completely. I'm like, man, I think this score is a lot better because it's less distracting. It's less like bombastic. It really serves the emotion of the story better.
It fits the mood of the movie too.
Yeah, it fits the fan. It's like it's very much a traditional like fantasy score, and it fits it much better. And I guess the reason why this changed so much is it didn't test well at the test screenings. Ridley Scott decided to cut it down to like an hour and a half, and he replaced the Jerry Goldsmith score of Tangerine Dream because he thought it would appeal more to a mass audience. And
I think that's the problem too with a lot of these directors. You have to learn that you got to do what you feel is right and not try to guess what the audience... Because he clearly second-guessed. He says himself that he second-guessed. And this is... I saw on the DVD, it said that this was his fourth movie. Duelists, I've never seen, so I don't know what that even is. But then there was Alien, which he has a director's cut to. There's Blade Runner, that's five cuts to. There's this, that has two cuts. He's always second-guessing himself, and...
I feel like he's the director that, like... I feel like almost more of his movies have extended cuts than, like, any other director.
I'd say Zack Snyder's Kingdom, second.
Well, yeah. Kingdom of Heaven, he has a longer cut on. There's a few others.
But to be fair, you also have to go by what the producers tell you, you know, like, and what the studio's telling you. You know, as far as goes for, yeah, you need to cut this down. I mean, in the 80s, there weren't a lot of really, really long movies theatrically released.
But I can't think of many movies where a single director has that many variations.
No.
And a lot of times, they don't even have the footage anymore. Oh, I shot this, but it was cut. It's lost. I don't know where that even is right now.
Yeah, we don't know if the studio told Ridley Scott or... I mean, according to him, it was his idea to cut it down and add in that score... But I know he came under fire for it. I guess I was reading that Tom Cruise won't even talk about this movie because he was so upset with the edits they made. And like Roger Ebert said that Director's Cut of Legend, the Director's Cut is one of his favorite movies, but not the theatrical cut.
Tom Cruise, too. This is a little bit mean, but everyone talks about how Tom Cruise fixed his teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, I mean, he doesn't have the worst teeth in the world, but he has a super nice smile now. His legend smile is, like, all different sized teeth.
This is very early Tom Cruise, too. I think this is... Isn't this, like, right after Top Gun, I think?
This would
no.
Been, no, this is before Top Gun. This would have been after... Was Outsiders before or after?
All the Right Moves, I think.
Yeah, that would have been around this.
This is, like...
Outsiders was first, though.
Yeah, Outsiders was first, and then All the Right
Maybe,
Moves,
like, 84
was
Outsiders,
second.
And then this.
Yeah.
Well, Mia Sara, which I thought her name was, like, Sara... Pichelio or something, so she cut that because no one's gonna get a short in that. But this is her very first movie. Her next movie is Ferris Bueller, and she pops up here and there, and it's like, I hate to say it, but yeah, like Ferris Bueller is her best movie. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
It's unfortunate because it's so early on in her career.
Yeah.
I did see, and maybe you, I did not, I saw this online in her filmography, so maybe you saw this, but she was Harley Quinn in Birds of Prey.
I was about to bring that up. There is a DC Comics TV show in I think 2002 called Birds of Prey. It was pretty terrible, but
I remember seeing the DVD cover of that when I worked at Walmart, because we'd always get it in like the $9.99 single season. The shows that just didn't make it, they'd be like the complete series, and be like the complete series for $10, and flip over all 18 episodes and be like, oh, it is the whole show for $10. Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty... It's one of the shows that it debuted with huge ratings, but then people realized it was awful, and they all just... The ratings just went down.
She hasn't been in anything for a couple years now.
Yeah, maybe she got out of the business, but yeah, she was, as far as I know, the first live-action Harley Quinn. She was like the seasoned villain of Birds of Prey.
I like her. She feels very natural. She even in this...
Mm-hmm.
Being the princess, like, out of her element and stuff, she feels like a very real person.
She's more prominent now than she was a few years ago, even. But she was in Time Cop. That's the only other big movie that I can think of.
Oh, yeah, she was in Time Cop.
That she was in.
But yeah, I think...
But even that was a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I think she's great in this. I think she... Other than Tim Curry, she probably gives the best performance, because... I'm a huge fan of Tom Cruise, but I think Tom Cruise is awful in this movie.
The weird thing about this movie is, too, it starts with the villain, which is okay to set it up. And then they go to Lily, which you would imagine would be the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
it's her a couple minutes, then she meets Tom Cruise, character Jack, who doesn't even, like, talk. He almost seems like he could be a woodland creature man in the beginning. And after they get separated, he becomes the main character. It's like a good 30 minutes into the movie before he's clearly the main character.
But do you know what this movie makes me think of? The way you described it, too, sets it up perfectly. It sounds exactly like The Legend of Zelda.
That's exactly what princess. I was gonna
say. That's her name. Her name's the main thing in the story. Is she the protagonist? No, this fucking guy that doesn't talk at all and
this
is
movie,
a fucking idiot.
This movie is 100% an influence to Legend of Zelda.
Oh, yeah.
Because, what is it? Miyamoto said that it was to begin with. And it does have... Even the element of like him going into a random cave to find the armor and the sword.
And the ring.
It looks like he's wearing like a green... He's basically just wearing a green tunic. Like,
That's
pretty
much
all they refer to him. They don't like call him an elf. They're just like, oh, you're a forest child, which is how he's referred to in many of the Zelda games.
Yeah. But even the cartoon, even Legend of Zelda, the cartoon that was at the end of Mario Brothers, the character himself
fuck off,
kind
Ganon.
Of reminds me of Tom Cruise's character in this.
Yeah, and I think I've read interviews with the creator of Zelda where he said Tom Cruise's character was the basis for Link. And yeah, you definitely see it because he's like mostly silent. Even the hair, too, like the hair, without being blonde, he looks kind of like Link.
Yeah, it has to become the hero. And it's not necessarily in the first Zelda, but the way that he has to destroy darkness is something that pops up definitely down the road in Zelda games with mirrors and light. And I love the plan that they know that they have to kill darkness with light, and they know that light's about to run out. And they get this master plan that if they just reflect mirrors, which they are easily find a lot of reflective mirrors.
It's thanks to Lily trying to, pretending like she's hypnotizing him.
And there's this great scene where, not a great scene, that is actually being great. I'm being hypocritical, or I'm criticizing this a lot. They set up a mirror, Tom Cruise and this one goblin, and they let it go, and it just stays there for no reason at all. Like, it's not leaned up against anything.
Yeah,
they just
like
set it down, and it balances, like, perfectly.
They're not mirrors. They're like giant like saucers or like giant plates.
That's what I thought
they
were.
Yeah, they take from the kitchen.
And Tom Cruise, well, they're whipping them around, which ends up the one goblin, I guess he's a troll. What is he?
They're dwarves.
He's a dwarf.
Yeah.
Which kind of reminds me of the first Hobbit movie when they're doing the dishes.
Oh, yeah.
And he falls into it and makes this loud noise and wakes up a 14-foot executioner dude.
Like the cooks, yeah, they're like giant. And they have to get this big fight.
I don't even think anybody eats in that movie. I do like how when they escape from the jail cell in the castle, or whatever you want to call it, and they split up and they're like, we're going to meet back here. And they set these random things that don't make any sense.
Yeah, he's got his weird ways of measuring times. Would have been three more swats of a badger's tail, we'd all be dead.
And they come back. They don't run into like any enemies or any sort of bad guys when they're down there.
And I guess it's hard to describe that whole final sequence. I can't tell what the geography of this place is. Like, they're just like Brown Tom and Screwball are just running around. They're just like, let's go this way, and he's like, no, let's go this way, and I'm like, where the fuck is everybody at? Like, they're showing them, they're like, now they're above Mia Sara. And then the one person's like, down here. And they're like, let's go to this room. I'm like, where the fuck are they at in this place?
Yeah, I can't really tell what this place is like. But I do love how they come up with the plan to kill Darkness, because Justin brought up earlier, you know, Darkness, he has a voiceover, and he's like, sunlight's my destroyer. Then when he's talking to Lily, like, he just loudly announces it for, like, no reason. He's like, Sunlight's my destroyer! And I'm like, you know, if I had this weakness that could be exploited, I wouldn't go around shouting it.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, Jack and them here, and they...
I think he was trying to get her to empathize with the reason why he wanted eternal darkness and wanted to kill the unicorn.
Maybe.
I'm trying
to... It was just awful the way it came off.
Oh, the best line in the whole movie is when Screwball says, I vote we run like hell. And Brown Tom says, I second that motion. It's like one of the few moments where I feel like the comedy kind of lands. But it is weird because after touching the unicorn, I know we're jumping back a little bit. After touching the unicorn, Lily and Jack are sitting on the edge of a cliff, and she's like, whoever gets this ring can wed me, and she throws it into the river, or a creek, or the ocean.
Yeah, that's what I said, yeah.
When she leaps into it, you brought it up.
You mean when he leaps into it.
Yeah, when he leaps into it.
Yeah.
It's so funny because the following scene was, you fucked everything up by touching that unicorn, and then became the romantic, like, if you get my ring, then you can marry me.
Yeah.
But transition-wise, you kind of want Tom Cruise in the water before he comes out so he can burst through ice. Like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, it's weird how he goes from being mad at her to, like, diving after this ring to try and marry her. But in her defense, like, he didn't really do much to stop her from touching the... Because
he's like, Lily.
Yeah, yeah, he's just there. There's nothing, like, stopping him from going up to her and just grabbing her. But he's just there, like, don't do it.
Maybe something earlier in the script that doesn't play on the screen is that he can't control her or he can't tell her what to do. He can't intervene, maybe.
Well, yeah. he can't really, I mean, if she's a princess, he could have his arms chopped off for that. So
I think Darkness should have found the ring and just been like, I found the ring. And she's like, it's okay. I like being this evil-looking chick, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she looked good. She rocked the evil
true goth.
Yeah, her goth phase.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she must be some sort of dancer, because she dances good in this, and she dances in Ferris Bueller. Although, I think she's definitely young in this. She's probably, like, just 18, if that.
Yeah, I was reading she was 17 when they started filming.
And Tom Cruise is around, he's early 20s in this movie. And Tim Curry's probably 50. I have no idea how old Tim Curry is in this.
Yeah, I don't know how old he was. This was post Rocky Horror, I know that, because that's how he got this role, but I don't know how old he was at the time of doing this.
He has a really distinct voice, and it's interesting that they like to have these things where he's in a lot of makeup or a villain. It works, though.
Yeah, I mean, like, his voice coming out from underneath that makeup, like, it's just so commanding. Like, his presence, like, he really makes up for the lack of screen presence that Tom Cruise has in this movie. Because, like I said, I love him, but I feel like he's still learning in this movie.
He doesn't really take off until Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
Yeah,
that's where he really gets his craft.
Seriously, Clue.
Clue is like, he was still learning a lot. It was Home Alone 2, Lost in New York.
I was talking about Tom Cruise, not Tim Curry. Tim Curry has always been perfect.
Yeah, Tom Cruise. I can't think of the first movie with Tom Cruise that I thought.
Top Gun.
Top Gun is a little goofy.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I'm thinking like the first role where I'm like, damn, he's actually pretty sharp.
For me, it was Top Gun. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I like
Top Gun's a fun movie, but it's not like a heavy. It's something that really shows off his skills. He's just a handsome.
Dies,
even Val Kilmer wants him.
Dies, seriously? I think you're just a little bit. I don't know. I don't agree with that.
I'd probably say Rain Man for me is probably when he really started to show his chops.
And that was the movie where everyone's like, look at Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
And he's like, are you kidding me? I'm really trying real hard in this movie.
But yeah, I think that. But no, my favorite Tom Cruise role is probably in Collateral, where he plays a villain.
Yes.
Like, I think he really shows what he can do with that role. But no more villain roles for Tom Cruise now. Now he's always the action hero.
What was his last one? Tropic Thunder.
Oh yeah.
He's technically a villain.
Yeah, he is.
My favorite. Was reading somewhere for they were talking about when they were making Legend that they had a hard time. They were gonna get like I think like normal. Not little people. They're gonna get like, I think someone said like Mickey Rooney to play like one of the roles, and they're like, but when you put Mickey Rooney and Tom Cruise side by side, Mickey Rooney didn't look short enough, like, because Tom Cruise isn't that tall either. They're like, they look like they're the same height. We can't now. We have to get like actual little people.
That's weird, yeah, because they frame Darkness to look massive, and then his fight scenes opposite Tom Cruise. I'm like, they probably didn't have to frame him at all to look big.
He just
looked
like right there. Tom Cruise
so
is
how
just
did,
really little.
So do they? This might be a spoiler for anybody that has not watched the movie. Does Tom Cruise Jack figure out a way how to defeat darkness and save Lily.
He does. And that leads us to, I guess, the final battle, which Chuck brought up the geography of this place. That's where the geography is really weird.
Yeah.
Because there's like a doorway in the space, it looks like.
Yeah.
The back of this place.
Oh, yeah, that it gets blasted into, that you're like, what is that?
Yeah.
What?
That's nothingness.
Yeah. Yeah. He's going to do... the whole thing is Lily convinces Darkness that she loves him, and she asks him to let her kill the unicorn. And it looks like she's going to do it, and Tom Cruise is conflicted. He has, like, a bow, and he's conflicted over whether or not to shoot her. And, of course, Gump, like...
Kill her!
Yeah, Gump can barely contain his blood.
Kill her, Jack!
He's like, kill her!
If you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it right now!
Well, at first he says that line about, don't look at her with your eyes, look at her with your heart.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is totally conflicting to what he says next. It's contrary to what he says next when he says, kill her!
But he does like riddles.
But it's not a riddle. It's just he's telling him, like, don't look at who she is. Think about who she was, you know, more or less. And then the next thing, it's like, she's really going to do it. She's really going to do it. Like, you're not taking your own advice. You know,
yeah, I thought that too. I'm like, okay, Gump's like telling Tom Cruise not to, keep the faith. And then, then 5 minutes later, he's like, fucking kill her. Like, do it.
That's where I think maybe something's lost in translation.
Either
like,
that,
if they had an extra scene that showed, like, something happened,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, you have to do it now, I'm sorry, like, I take back what I said, you have to kill her.
But yeah, so it looks like she's gonna kill the unicorn, but she cuts it free, and the devil, like, knocks the darkness devil. But yeah, he knocks her down, and Tom
The devil can't keep me down.
Yeah. But Tom Cruise and Darkness get into a sword fight, where Tom Cruise spends most of the sword fight getting his ass kicked.
Yeah.
But what's Tom Cruise's final move?
Is to stab Darkness with the unicorn horn.
Damn.
And he throws it.
And then he knocks Darkness into that...
Darkness.
He knocked him into the Phantom Zone. Yeah, that was odd.
Yeah.
Which, once again, there's Gump, like, the whole... Because Darkness is, like, clinging to the edge of this while sunlight's, like, hitting him. And he's, like...
It's, like, so perfectly timed, too, because it's, like, the sun is reflected off all these pans all the way down into the thing, and then, for whatever reason, it blows the doors off.
Yeah.
Which I didn't understand at all.
Yeah, I didn't get that either. The sunlight blows open these doors.
And it's at the same exact time when Tom Cruise throws the unicorn
Maybe
horn.
In this magical world, sunlight is openly trying to kill darkness.
The only thing I can think that it might be was when he stabbed him with the unicorn horn, that he lost his power to hold those doors shut.
Yeah.
So it was like a magical thing, and that's why the sunlight was able to...
I was thinking that, or maybe because this is Darkness's domain, that the sunlight is just destructive towards everything it comes across.
Or a couple things, they have magical doors with dark curses on it, so when sunlight touches it, it just explodes.
Maybe, yeah. But yeah, the sunlight hits Darkness, and he's like clinging to the edge of this precipice, and he's kind of... convincing Tom Cruise not to kill him while Gump is, like, advocating...
Forrest Gump. Yeah, just yelling from...
Kill him! But, I really love the shot where Tom Cruise is walking towards Darkness with the sword up. And, like, the wind's blowing and, like, he's backlit. Like, it's beautifully lit. But, he ends up, it looks like he chops off Darkness's hand. And
yeah, because he's still got the unicorn horn in his hand after he pulls it out of him.
Yeah, and he falls into this nothingness. And it looks like he is... broken up into stars.
Yeah.
It's like a constellation. Yeah.
I'm thinking like Draco or something.
Yeah.
He becomes the Big Dipper.
Maybe, yeah. But yeah, they grab the unicorn horn, and this is in the theatrical cut, but not in the director's cut. In the theatrical cut, they show them putting the horn back on the unicorn, and it comes back to life.
I thought so, yeah.
The one shot earlier with the dead unicorn in the snow,
mm-hmm.
it looks pretty good. Like, I'm sure it's a prop of some sort, but it looks like a legit covered horse in snow.
Yeah, there's lots of beautiful there's that, or the shot where Lily's kneeling in the creek to touch the unicorn. It looks like something you'd see in, like, an old medieval painting. Like, it looks beautiful, and that's a lot of this movie. But yeah, in the theatrical cut, they show them putting the horn back on the unicorn and brings it back to life. In the director's cut, it only shows the two unicorns together at the end.
Yeah, they're just like, it
got
we
that.
Did something.
Yeah. And you know, Jack finds, he finds the ring, and they say that Lily's under a spell after darkness hit her, but he finds the ring and puts it back on her and kisses her and tells her he loves her. And she wakes up and goes back to her, presumably her castle, when Jack stays in the woods. And that is legend.
It's beautiful.
The theatrical cut also has a hint during the credits that darkness is still alive.
Yeah.
I don't think maybe I did have it play. What's the hint? A voice or something?
No, the theatrical cut, like, it, the theatrical cut seems to have, like, the director's cut.
Oh, the hint is in the theatrical cut?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Because at the end of the director's cut, Jack and Lily, like, they admit they love each other, but it still seems like they're still, like, early on in their relationship. Like, she goes back to wherever, and he stays in the woods, where...
She gives him the ring to wear.
Yeah. But it's still very much like a, you know, we'll be there for each other, but we're not quite, like, there yet.
Yeah.
Which I think is, like, kind of a mature ending for a movie
yeah.
like this. But the theatrical cut has a happily ever after, we love each other. And, like, it shows them, like, walking off in the woods together. And then the credits start rolling. But then, like, while they're walking off, they show darkness laughing, like, his face superimposed over them. And then it goes to credits. So, like, definitely being like, there might be a sequel.
Kids will love it if we put Tim Curry back in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, that tease of possible sequel. They never had one.
They never did, no.
No, there's,
Maybe somebody should try to troll Ridley Scott into saying they're going to make a Legend sequel so he can say, no, I was working on that.
It would be funny because, well, he jumped on wanting to do the next Blade Runner after Blade Runner 2049 came out and did so well critically.
Mm.
It'd be funny if he's like, I'm assuming somebody's going to want to do Legend, so it's going to be me.
I think, like, the thing about Legend is I'd say, like, they could do a remake, but I don't think a remake's going to, at least from a visual standpoint, look like this movie does.
It'd be very CG heavy.
Yeah, it would. It just wouldn't have the same magic. I mean, figure he'd probably use Jim Henson's creature shop.
Yeah,
heavily in the first one.
Some of the stuff though, like Alien Covenant, which is the last Ridley Scott like heavy effects movie that came out, but most of it really doesn't look too bad. Yeah, there's some CG in it, and I definitely would use CG in this.
Yeah, I just don't think that it would have the same feel. It would be like Labyrinth.
Yeah.
They're going to redo Labyrinth, and they're talking about like how CG it would be.
I think it depends on how, like, who is in charge of it, because I would want it to be some sort of sequel. I would want the original story to exist in some way, and maybe the Return of Darkness, because you could easily do that makeup and maybe have a voice actor that's similar.
Yeah.
And then maybe it has something to do with their kid, since that's what all the future stuff do. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, I would want the look to look as similar as it possibly could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or if you're going to update it in the way that feels like the way things would
show the castle.
Go.
Yeah, show the castle, show the kingdom. But I think the visual, like, the visual symmetry of this movie should stay the same. If they do another one, which I don't think there's a demand for a Legend 2, Legend Harder, but, but, yeah.
Legend of the Legend.
Yeah. But, yeah, I'd love to see this world explored more, because, like, there is a lot of questions I had, like, you know, essentially, who is Darkness? Like, what is this? Like, that's my big thing, is no character really gets any backstory. Like, we don't really know anything about Jack or Lily, or, like, even Darkness. Like, we know he has some sort of all-powerful father that he talks to.
Well, the one thing that we know for sure is if you ask Ridley Scott anything, he just straight up answers it, no matter how ambiguous he makes his film.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll just ask him all these questions.
Yeah, ask him, like, so what's the deal with Darkness and Jack? And I think, like, they're trying to go with a fairy tale type. They obviously were trying to go with a fairy tale type thing, but in fairy tales, nobody really has a backstory. They're just there. But, you know, storytelling has changed a bit, and you kind of have to explain what this world is and the rules of this world, and that's one thing I don't think this film did really well. But I will say, I do think that the director's cut is a much better movie, because it does kind of give you room to breathe and does kind of give these characters a little bit more room to shine.
It does a really good job of when I was younger and you're flipping through channels and it came on, no matter what part of the movie you're watching, it kind of just does grab you in. It's like suck you into that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing like the unicorns and being like, I don't know. And then shortly after, everything's being covered with snow. And I'm like, this is cool. I don't know what's going on, but I'll watch.
Yeah, and it's, that's one of the things. When you're a kid, like, you're... And I think it's just because it is kind of a universal story, you know, good versus evil. And you get it, like, what the unicorns represent, what Lord of Darkness represents, obviously, what Jack represents. And, yeah, you can kind of come into this movie at any point. In the
fantasy genre, I think that in almost all our movies, good versus evil is a pretty prominent theme in every single one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Probably most fantasy that you think of in general.
Yeah, they're typically morality plays, or like some fairy tales and fantasies are trying to teach a lesson, which I don't really think there's much of a lesson in this one. But that's also why I...
Don't give in to darkness.
Don't fuck with unicorns.
Yeah, don't fuck with unicorns. But
it could be an environmental message. Don't hurt the wildlife.
Yeah. You could say that unicorns are like kind of like Mother Earth. Don't fuck with it. Or
yeah, save the planet.
Climate change happens immediately upon screwing with these animals.
Upon touching a unicorn.
These people are talking about global warming, but I see snow everywhere.
The castle just doesn't believe.
Yeah.
Global warming is a myth. Just like unicorns.
Maybe that's why it's in this fantasy, because it's a myth.
Maybe, yeah. that's what this is. It's a religious, it's a global warming analogy.
Yeah, that's beautiful when you think of it that way.
Yeah. Ridley Scott was ahead of things. He thought that through.
Final thoughts on the movie?
I think it's one of my favorite parts is when he has Mia Sara and he says, he's showing her like that long table. I just love that everything is black. It reminds me of like the memes.
Darkness you're talking about?
Yeah, okay. When Darkness is showing her like his feast and he's like, doesn't it? I'll share this all with you. And it's like black food. Like it's like a black cornucopia full of food.
You don't
black plates, black dishes. And I'm just like, yeah, that looks super appetizing. I'm glad that was your selling point.
When you talk about that long table, there's like a little person on the table too.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, get that guy off the table.
There's also something else in that scene that I was like, what the?
Because it's weird, like something's gonna like sucker into the chair.
Yeah.
Like, why don't you take a seat? And she's like, I think I'll do that. I'll stand. And he's like, son of a bitch.
he hits that goblet.
Like, yeah.
I thought of it more as like the darkness. Was part of the chair, like the chair was part of darkness, and she was kind of like sitting on his lap.
That's what I was wondering, because he's trying to get her to sit in his chair, and like, yeah, there's something like rising up out of the chair. And then there's like, it has like on the armrest are like claws. It looks like statues.
Maybe it's like sexual.
But they start moving. That's what I thought. I'm like, is this going with this really overt sexual imagery?
What is coming out of it? Oh my god.
Yeah, because it's like rising and falling, and then she's like, oh no, I'll stand. And he gets really pissed off.
I forgot about that. That's a really funny.
Stop blue balling.
That's a really funny, almost out of context scene when she says, I'll stand. And he's like, son of a bitch.
In the theatrical cut, it is because they take out that weird sex chair or whatever, because he's just like, sit. She's like, I'll stand. And he just like throws it up.
And that reminds me of Beauty and the Beast a lot too, where the goes word of the wooing, even though this is clearly Satan and not a misunderstood man that's been changed into a beast.
Hey, we don't know his backstory.
Right, yeah.
There's one thing we've learned, yeah, he might just be a misunderstood person.
So, I know that's a little off subject, but if we did the sequel, we'd have to have Darkness's backstory. And he had to have started like a good person.
And his chair.
Yeah, I want to know about that chair. His weird sex chair.
You need to ask Ridley Scott.
I'll ask Ridley Scott about
that. It's the equivalent of Star Wars if we get a sequel. I want to know who Darkness's parents are, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ridley Scott decides to punish us. And he's like, here's a prequel about Darkness when he was a child and a slave.
I would just call it Return of Darkness and leave it at that.
Was it? I think, I'm going to look this up, but I think that they did mention that if there was a sequel, that's what it would be called.
I thought that off the top of my head, so it's definitely where it has to be.
I might be wrong, but I could have sworn I read that somewhere that like they're planning a sequel called Legend Return of Darkness, but then this flopped.
I wouldn't even call it Legend, like because then that way it could be its own movie, and if you saw Legend, cool. But if you didn't see Legend, you don't need to, because this is the backstory of Darkness.
I was like, I watched a trailer for this, and this flopped pretty hard. But like watching the trailers, I'm like, I'd totally see this movie because all the marketing is around Darkness. Like the whole trailer is like, look at this badass character.
Yeah.
And like me, if I was like old enough in the 80s, I'd be like, this is so fucking metal. I'm seeing this movie. I don't care what it's about.
You know? The cover of the DVD of just that poster, which is him massive. And then he has like a little like globe that like shows little tiny Tom Cruise and Mia Sara. But it's mainly, look how awesome this thing looks.
And I'm pretty sure the globe is something the goblins and the dwarves were using for time meeting up.
I will also say this because Lexi brought this up in the last episode, but she goes, there must have been a PA dedicated entirely to glitter in this movie, because everything is covered in glitter in this movie.
And then sometimes we get the random bubbles when Una shows up.
Yeah.
There's randomly bubbles coming somewhere from off screen.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. There's a bubble and glitter PA.
Oh, yeah. That one moment there when it just snowed. And then there are a shitload of bubbles for no reason.
like, they turned the machine on and it just started, like, pumping them out like crazy.
Because at first you think it's, like, snowing, and you're like, wait a minute, those are bubbles. It's never explained. They just, the bubbles are gone. Well, by the time the goblins come up to, like, fight. Any final thoughts?
Darkness reigns.
I would say, out of context, not really rewatching the theatrical, try to watch the director's cut for sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit, it's about 20 minutes longer than it's 20 minutes longer than the theatrical cut, but at least it seems like the story flows a lot nicer from what you've been telling me.
Yeah, like I said, my opinion's changed a lot in this movie watching the director's cut, and I think the director's cut is, while not a perfect movie, or I'd say even like a good movie, it's a much better, much more watchable movie. You savor it a lot more than a theatrical cut, because I think the theatrical cut is insanely fast-paced, where you can't really take it in, and I think the director's cut does a much better job of kind of pulling you in.
And this is probably a good movie for, like, production design, art design, makeup, maybe hair, I don't know.
Yeah, I'd say for those technical things, it's great, but even, you know, going back to the difference between cuts as far as editing goes, like, just watching how they just rearrange some shots, or just would let one shot kind of drag out a little bit longer, seeing the impact that had on pacing is huge. Like, if you want to learn about how editing can help a movie, I'd say watch both versions of this back to back.
Yeah, that's a good learning. Well, that is our show.
That is Legend.
You can find us on Twitter at Cinema D'Amore. I'm at JJ Morgan 19.
Sinister Dick.
Chuck Finn 66.
James Reinhardt.
Please listen to us on iTunes and Google Play Music. Subscribe. If we get more ratings and reviews, I said on the Spaceballs episode that I'll give out a code for the killing of a sacred deer. And maybe a code for the lobster, if it works. So you definitely get one movie, maybe the other. That's still on the table. Once we have a total of 5 reviews, we'll give it to somebody. I think that's fair. But more importantly, hopefully you're pumped about fantasy.
Yeah, I'm very excited to discuss a lot of the movies we're discussing this coming month.
Chuck, would you like to tease yours, or just flat out say it?
I'll just flat out say it. It's Clash of the Titans. Not starring Sam Worthington.
Nice.
Or Liam Neeson.
Or Liam Neeson.
Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.